good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp, foggy midnight, you snort my good pony and you give me your best. For you know and I know, good horse amongst the rich ones, how oft times we go there, an unwelcome guest.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. Since the WTO protests in Seattle, the issue of property destruction as a protest tactic has been in the national spotlight. Police departments and other officials have issued a variety of statements and engaged in surveillance and raids on activist premises under the guise of suppressing the potential for property destruction. They view property destruction as merely a criminal act, which cannot be legally justified under the protection of the U.S. Constitution. Based on the language of the First Amendment, that Congress shall make no law, quote, abridging the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances, unquote, they would appear to be correct. The use of the word petition is key. A petition is a request made by a subordinate to a superior who may reject that petition. Then what? The American colonists made numerous petitions to the British Crown, which were ignored. Ultimately, they dressed up in disguises and tossed tea overboard in the dead of night, declared independence, and took up arms. Tonight, we're going to look at tactics of protest and examine the assumptions underlying them. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary.
Lying and gambling, and I take it my way, my shiny black.
On July 13th, the Earth Liberation Front, ELF, claimed responsibility for antibiotech direct actions at the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratories in Long Island, New York, the first known incident of such action in the state. Under the cover of night, activists evaded security and destroyed 2 acres of GMO corn and several greenhouses worth of seedlings. They also monkey-wrenched several trucks and spray-painted anti-genetic messages everywhere. In so doing, it is estimated that 2 years of genetic experiments were destroyed. Recent similar actions took place last week in biotech facilities in Maine and California. Activists explained their reasons in a July 20th release as follows. Cold Spring Harbor Lab is notorious as a 100-year-old institution that has pioneered the science of genetic engineering. Its labs are responsible for research related to the, quote, discovery of hybrid vigor, which led to increased corn production and to a revolution in crop breeding, unquote, now more commonly known as the, quote, Green Revolution, and identified by thousands of activists and scholars from the Global South as a root cause of the starvation and depletion of soil and biodiversity occurring at breakneck pace around the planet. Cold Spring Harbor Laboratories and the Watson School of Biological Sciences are key components in the life sciences industry, where the natural evolution of organisms are dissected, manipulated to fit the demands of the market, and profited from by huge agrochemical pharmaceutical genetic conglomerates such as Monsanto, Dow Chemical, and Celera. Regardless of the nonprofit nature of CSHL, the research conducted there in the name of modern progress only serves to deepen the crisis in human health, agriculture, and biodiversity. the quest for funding and thirst for more knowledge that drives the science industry toward a redesigning of life, rather than researching solutions based on ecological sustainability and respect for the limits of our Earth's life support systems, are arrogant and dangerous. Searching for super-technological solutions to problems caused by capitalist exploitation and industrialism does a great disservice to the future of humanity by ignoring the reciprocal and highly probable effects of tampering with basic life processes. Direct actionists have demonstrated that they believe in going beyond the legally sanctioned forms of protest to draw attention to the grave dangers facing society that are rarely challenged. And that was from a press release issued by the Earth Liberation Front regarding a direct action of destruction of a biotech facility in Cold Springs Harbor, Long Island. In 1998, a multi-million-dollar ski lodge was burned down by environmental activists in Vail, Colorado, and a Nike Town store was trashed during an anti-sweatshop protest in Eugene, Oregon. As this militant form of protest was becoming more prevalent in Eugene and igniting controversy among the activist community, a roundtable discussion on the issues of nonviolence, activism, and property destruction was broadcast on public access television. We bring you the soundtrack of that discussion, which is, as far as I know, the most comprehensive debate on that issue between activists.
Eugene, Oregon, long a nexus of progressive activity in the Pacific Northwest, has in recent years experienced an escalation in the tone of political protests. While relatively tame sign-carrying, slogan-chanting events still occur, it is increasingly common for demonstrations to result in property damage and clashes with police. The local political landscape has been rocked by high-profile conflicts such as occurred on June 1, 1997, when several protesters defending downtown trees were literally saturated with pepper spray. While there had been serious clashes previously, June 1st proved to be a turning point, convincing many here that more radical actions were justified. The subsequent year and a half has seen the emergence of black blocs, groups of people who wear similar clothing, gas masks and such, attending protests prepared to confront police and vent their rage on capitalist establishments. There has also been a surge in night actions against businesses perceived to be spearheading gentrification in low-income neighborhoods. Actions ranging from urban anti-corporate activities to forest defense have prompted discourse among activists in Eugene on the nature and definition of nonviolence and the place of property destruction in the struggle. The recent arson of a ski resort complex in Vail, Colorado has heightened the intensity of the debate. The government and media have suggested connections between the fire at Vail and events closer to home, such as the arson of a ranger station near Oak Ridge, Oregon in 1996. A Eugene action against sweatshop shoemaker Nike on October 17th was denounced by the Campaign for Labor Rights after corporate property was damaged. The prospect of possible factionalism and splits in the movement has opened up new discussion on tactics and strategy and how to best create positive social change. What follows is a roundtable discussion broadcast November 4th on Cascadia Alive, a weekly public access television program produced by biocentric activists. Panelists include anarchist author and theorist John Zerzan, War Resisters League activist Ellen Clowden, prominent local environmental activists James Johnson and Tim Ream, and frequent contributor to the Earth First Journal, James Barnes, with taped segments from animal rights activist Jonathan Paul and an anonymous representative of the underground group Black Army Faction. The discussion begins with a short statement by environmentalist icon Edward Abbey.
I think we're morally justified to resort to whatever means are necessary in order to defend our land from destruction, invasion. I see this as an invasion. These look like creatures from Mars to me. I feel no kinship with that fantastic structure over there. No sympathy with it whatsoever. Yeah, I would advocate sabotage, subversion, as a last resort when political means fail.
All right, here we are. This is Cascadia Alive. My name is Craig. I'll be moderating a forum we're having this evening. Last few weeks, we have seen protests at the Nike building here in Eugene. We saw an arson fire at the Vail Ski Resort in Colorado, kind of prompting a lot of questioning in the environmental movement especially, about appropriate tactics and methods for social change, for environmental change. We're going to have a little round table here tonight with some of Eugene's finest minds on the matter. I think we're going to start with a videotaped clip from Jonathan Paul. He's a member of SEDNA, the Sea Defense Alliance, and he had a few words about what violence and strategy and tactics mean. I think we're going to start with that and then come back to the group here and let them say a few words about just what violence and nonviolence is.
My name is Jonathan Paul. I've been an animal and environmental activist since 1986. Mostly I've been working in animal rights issues. I'm a staunch vegan. I've been arrested one time for an alleged ALF raid here at University of Oregon in 1986. I was indicted in 1990, but the case fell through, and under lack of evidence, I was released and the case was dropped. I also spent 5 months in jail because I wouldn't give information over to the U.S. government about other political activists, namely people in animal rights movement and some people in their first movement. And I stayed in jail until I was released 5 months later, back in 1992-93.
Do you think that actions of civil disobedience, overt actions, can be effective?
I would never stand out against civil disobedience or any kind of action in support of the earth or animals or any kind of oppression. I do feel that they are actions that work better than others. I do feel TD works. Though I do feel that CD works the best when you have large amounts of people.
Are there times when other types of actions that may involve property damage justified?
For sure. I definitely think that the Animal Liberation Front, the Earth Liberation Front, and other underground direct action groups definitely have a place in this movement, and I feel that their actions are justified in the sense that the people that are doing the destruction on this planet at enormous levels, this is the retribution that is coming back to them for all the destruction that they're doing. And what happens is basically all this kind of goes back to the government and the corporations, because they're doing so much plundering and pillaging that it makes people react in a very aggressive way. And as long as no life is taken, well, I think the actions are justified.
So Jonathan's basic point, I think, is that violence is injury to a living thing. What do you all think about that? Anyone have a comment? Any differences of opinion there, or is that this is John Zerzan. He's the author of Future Primitive and other essays, well-known writer.
Well, the question of violence, he posed it in terms of civil disobedience, and I have a problem with civil disobedience from maybe the other point of view. In other words, that CD is where people accept their roles within a framework that respects the basic setup of things. So to me, the object of where I'm starting from, and I hope others are, is to abolish and dismantle the global system that's continuing and it's accelerating destruction of nature and society and a lot of things we all know. I'm not going to go off into that. But CD aims at preserving a certain legitimacy that certainly does not collide with the system. It accepts the rules of the game and the consequences, and so I think it's a tiresome thing that goes nowhere, in my view.
Well, I just was thinking about the definition of violence that he had to say, which is, essentially do no harm to living things. I'm not sure I agree with that, because violence involves intent as well as action. People talk a lot about property destruction and so on. Is it violence and is it not? I think that the effect that it produces has a lot to do with it, the goal. Is it meant to dissuade? Is it a form of force? I mean, I think that I was thinking about, in terms of broken windows, something like Kristallnacht is a rehearsal, if you like, for the Holocaust that comes later. To say that breaking windows of stores that belong to Jews in Nazi Germany is a nonviolent action would be a mistake. So just to put it in that context.
That was James Barnes, local Earth Firster. And this is Ellen Clowden of Eugene Peace Works, member of the War Resisters League.
Right. I'd like to echo what James Barnes just said. When I was thinking about delineating what I thought was violence and what was not violence, I thought it doesn't just have to be whether or not harm to living beings actually immediately results. It can be harm, it can be intent of harm, threat of harm, or implication of threat of harm. and I would also include actions that may or may not immediately result in harm, but where insufficient planning was taken to minimize any sort of risk of harm. I definitely concur that you gave an example of damage to property that was an insinuation of threat and intimation of anticipation of threat to life. And then I delineate among acts of property damage between those that are enacted with pacifist intent and tone and those enacted with not pacifist intent or tone, rather than labeling acts of property damage violent or nonviolent if they were not undertaken with any intent to imply or cause harm to life.
Well, I don't want to get into a semantical debate, but I do think it's important to establish a definition of what's violent and what's nonviolent. The status quo media considers anything that attacks the status quo, no matter what form it takes, to be violent. I think that you're violent whenever you cause harm to another living being or by your actions allow to be harmed another being. And I don't think that we can judge intent or outcomes accurately or adequately. And I just think if I break a stool over, you know, on the ground, that's nonviolent. Judge my intent or the outcome of it however you will. When Pacific Lumber goes out and clear cuts an entire watershed, that is violent because it's attacking, you know, the ecosystem that we all depend on. And I think we should stay away from playing into the status quo's definition of violence in that way.
This was James Johnston.
So my name's Tim. As far as the violence, I think that, first of all, what I'd like to say is I feel like violence is a continuum. I don't think that there's sort of an on-off switch to violence where we can say nonviolent, 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 violent, 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 violent. I think that there's a continuum of that where we can start seeing violence sort of creeping into a particular behavior. But then I think the other thing that's really important to recognize, I feel like violence is subjective. I feel like there is something of an eye of a beholder or even an eye of a victim with regard to violence. So that I personally feel like clear-cut logging is violent. I feel like factory farming that results in a McDonald's hamburger is violent. And, you know, I feel like I could make a strong case to any hamburger-eating person if I could take them to a factory farm and show them that, or if I could take them to a clear-cut and show them that. But the fact of the matter is, most people who are viewing actions that we might be involved in for social change have a different perspective. Now, I've learned a lot about this perspective, especially from women, because I've been told that even my words are sometimes felt to be violent. I once, in a discussion with Judy Berry, where I was feeling a lot of emotion, pounded my fist on the ground, and she went off on me big time, but that was a violent act and that she felt threatened by what I had done. So I felt like I had to respect that to some extent as violence being in the eye of the person who is feeling as if they have been subjected to some sort of level of violence. And I just want to say one other word that I think is important to talk about is this terrorism word that's being thrown around really loosely, eco-terrorism. And I think it's really important to point out how in the media, terrorism usually refers to death and destruction of human beings unless the word eco is put in front of it, and then property damage suddenly falls into the realm of eco-terrorism. And I think that that's kind of something that intelligent consumers of the media really have to watch for.
I think Tim's right. We do have to respect how other people perceive us, other people like our friends and comrades. But the status quo, corporate America, hell no. They might perceive us to be violent, but they're wrong, and we should categorically reject their perception and their impression of our actions. And we should project that and not cop to something that's just not violent, just because it's violent to their bottom line.
This past summer, I heard someone say something along the lines of, if the general public perceives something as violent, then it is. There's not going to be any real difference in terms of politics, whether or not our definition of it is nonviolent. If people think it's violent, then it is violent. What do you all think about that?
I categorically oppose that. And if you think about the reverse of that statement, if the general public doesn't perceive something as violent, does that mean that it's not violent? I worked for 6 years in the battered women's movement, and presently I'm a medical social worker, and I work with battered women in that context now. And a lot of times, the perpetrator, various family members, sometimes even members of the law enforcement community, don't immediately grasp that the situation that the survivor is articulating was violent. Maybe it didn't quite fit how some legislature defined domestic violence, or maybe they just aren't ready to accept it. That doesn't mean that the person didn't get the shit beat out of them or didn't get raped or something like that. And so, given that I come from that background, I have to reject that statement.
Tim, I think we have to recognize what the general society perceives to be violent, but we don't have to accept, because if we fail to recognize it, our strategies are going to fail. But if we accept it, then our strategies are worthless. The whole social change movement within this country is about changing public definitions like this, and I feel like that's one of our most important roles, is an education of the public towards this biocentric, life-respecting perspective. You used to be able to have slaves. It wasn't considered violent. You could beat them and you could rape them. A man could rape his wife, and it was considered to be nonviolent.
It still is.
In some countries.
There are marital rape exemptions in several states. I think it's like 20-some-odd states, where it's actually written into the law, X behavior equals rape unless it's against your wife.
So I feel like what we have is a situation where clearly violent things in the media are not being considered to be violent, and other things are considered to be violent because they're against the system. And it's our job more than anything else to clearly point out where these inconsistencies lie and try to get to a higher level of respect for life and to articulate that through this kind of a definitional formation.
James?
Just a comment on both of this stuff. I think the point that I was sort of making earlier, and I think has been articulated pretty well around here, is that I think that it's not a matter of violence or nonviolence. I think you said continuum. I think almost anything we do in standing up in opposition to force and power is, to some extent, a mirror image of that, a response, and that involves aggression, and it involves sometimes things that are intent to intimidate. We were talking about that as being quasi-violence and so on. And I think that we just simply need to own the idea of violent response of force, that it's something we're capable of, and we all do. When something happens, such as an arson, such as smashing of a Nike store or what have you, and nonviolence ideologues talk about, you know, oh my God, you guys are violent and we're nonviolent, I think that it's almost meaningless what they're saying, and setting up where we have to be defensive, those of us who don't believe in the nonviolence ideology, and say, well, you know, we're not really violent. I mean, I think it is somewhat violent, and I don't think that people need entirely to try to deny the obvious when it comes down to that.
So I think we're going to switch to a video segment from a member of the BAF, which I believe stands for the Black Army Faction. Here are his points on the whole thing, on strategies of social change and where we're at here in Eugene. So here we go.
Activity and activist activity, such as the August 2nd Wildhall riot and October 17th protest against Nike. Much attention has been drawn to the debate of violence versus nonviolence. It seems that as if the liberal leftists at Eugene Peace Workers, Oregon Peace Works, and unfortunately more often than not, Cascadia Live, would rather stick with no-win solutions like boycott campaigns, voting, and civil disobedience rather than taking a step forward in opposition to the modern system of domination and oppression. Cowardly acts like fasting, voting, and civil disobedience are not only outdated, but they virtually change nothing. If they're going to take a real stand against our corporate world, you must fight back, and fast, because the fate of freedom and the natural world and all living beings against the industrial authoritarian menace is in our hands. No more working within the system, no more playing by the rules. Wake the fuck up, Eugene. How many times have you gone out and stood in front of the federal building waving your signs and holding up two fingers? Is it too many times to count? Is it beyond your conception? Now think hard. How many times has it made a difference in the way these pigs think? How many of these masquerades happen a year, just locally? Would you say 50? Maybe 100? It's too hard to tell, considering you don't hear about any of them. Now let's think one last time. How many riots have happened through the course of 97 and 98? I'm counting five, including the two Halloween beer riots on campus. I'm also pretty sure, unless you are illiterate and don't watch TV, that you've heard about all five, let alone witnessed or took part in. I find it appalling that nobody ever took the time to realize that nonviolence, for the most part, isn't threatening the established system. Protest is meant to accomplish change, but if the protest doesn't affect the subject you wish to change, why would they care? The same question would be why the fall of the Nazi empire wasn't accomplished with vigils and marches. Of course, obviously, nonviolent protests wouldn't have had any effect on Adolf Hitler and his disciples. As the Nazi Party had complete control of Western Europe, the modern-day Nazis, a.k.a. EPD, and the other social organizations, have control of our anarchist and leftist movements. As we've seen, most unfortunately, with the alleged Nike protesters' house raided on Monday, the EPD suspects this 15-year-old anarchist of terrorism, animal laboratory raids, and rioting. This and other such instances, including the three arrests for wiring, could very easily be compared with the Red Scare of the 20th. The point that I'm trying to make is that it takes far more courage to use these so-called violent property-destroying means. It very much shows a person's devotion to the struggle. The thing is that standing can get boring. This is why we've chosen our path. Because a bottle leaving your hand headed for a cop feels good. Because the sound of breaking glass is music. And because reform is too slow and strenuous. On our side, there's not much homework involved. Being apolitical and hating everything that's pushed into you comes pretty fucking natural. And besides, who doesn't want to have fun?
Yeah, I think we want to have some reactions to that. Does anyone want to react to it?
I have one reaction right off the bat, and that is that I think this gentleman raises an important point. Namely, do we need to change the world? Yes. Have the tactics and strategy that we've adopted so far worked to change the world? No. And if anything else, this gentleman's challenging us to look at new ways of doing things, and I think that that's highly pertinent, to say the least.
Ken?
Well, James, I feel like have strategies that have been employed to change the world up until now worked. I sort of feel like we can't just categorically say no to that. I do feel like the situation of, let's say, 18th century Europe dominated by feudal lords or monarchs compared to the situation today is one where people do enjoy far more rights today. Having traveled through like 15 different African countries, I feel like people enjoy far more rights in this country. I feel like the role of women in this country is far more liberated and evolved than what society will allow in Africa. So I think like there are changes. I think they're significant. And I think if the monarchs of the 18th century had the tools of modern technology along with their current social system, the subjugation that we'd be under would be like a lot more intense. So some strategy worked, but at the same time, the earth is dying fast, and so they're not working fast enough. So on that level, I totally agree with you. And I think that this country and you know, for those of you out there who profess a Christian background, we can all the way go back to Jesus whooping butt on the temple steps and destroying the tables of the money changers, which you could say that was probably a violent act, as he like had whips in his hands and he was destroying property as he was going. The spark of the revolution in this country was the Boston Tea Party, and I'm sure far more dollars worth of tea were destroyed than Nike shoes were destroyed the other day, and yet the victor gets to tell the history. And so those boys on the ship that night were patriots, and yet the people who were over in the Nike store, until they get control of the media, will not be. But the last statement of the person on the clip really troubles me, and that is, besides, people want to have fun. And I think if we take and we mix up the very serious business of protest at this level, which includes property damage, which includes full-on confrontation with the system at that level, and we let our own anger, we let our own desire to have fun get mixed in with that, number one, we're going to have a hard time articulating why we're doing it. Number two, I think we're going to have a hard time doing it in a way that's highly effective.
I disagree, Tim. I don't think we're going to have a hard time articulating it, because I think even these beer riots over on campus and some subsequent stuff over on campus against the cops shows that in a society that's more and more empty and desolate and meaningless, people will resort to violence, and way more probably than we even think. I mean, people are outside the accepted channels. You can read the dissatisfaction, and I'm not making out necessarily drunken students as the acme of anything, but I don't think it's hard to understand at all. In fact, what I find hard to understand is how people wouldn't want to make a break with the system and oppose the system, given its fantastic destructiveness on all levels and what it's doing to people. You could just think of a million things just from the newspapers. Is everybody going to be on Paxil and Prozac? I know, like, friends of mine, it's not just the statistics. It's just becoming so awful. Where's the humanness? I mean, it's just a crisis on every level. And I think these sort of tame tactics that respect what is are just irrelevant. The passion of that kid on the thing rings a bell with me much more than the old song of voting and recycling and CD. That's meaningless to me. It's less than meaningless. It's holding things back. The dogma that denounces the violence is working for the system.
What's your alternative to CD and recycling?
I think we need to lift the dogma against violence, against the system, breaking with the system. There's from all sides, you get, especially in the media, of course, but not just the media, all these restrictions on how to behave in order to change things. I mean, what kind of change do you want? The masochism of reform, I think that's a good phrase. Until we smash the system, until we sweep it away, what chance do we have? What chance does the natural world have? So things that go in that direction, you can think of a lot of creative things once they're not always being suppressed and marginalized and put down, it seems to me.
James?
I agree, John. I think that people who are in the sort of traditional social change movements that have involved civil disobedience and so on, often we get into the nuances and we finesse ourselves silly with worrying about what's violent and what's not, whereas you got kids doing beer riots and fighting with the cops without spending a lot of time with calm, rational thought about it. They're reacting and they're doing stuff, whereas a lot of activists are afraid to do that kind of thing, that sort of basic courage of let's get out there and heck with you. And also, I mean, let's not forget, you know, we worry very much, are we going to be labeled violent? You know, we're going to deny this violent act over here. Well, what are the cops but organized, violent body set up to enforce the rules of the system? They're not nonviolent, you know? So I don't think that we get to give up our rights to respond.
Ellen?
First, I'd like to say that I believe that there are definitely times where inaction is more violent than whatever type of action someone can take. Okay? Second, I believe that there are people who make moral judgments in both directions. Some people make a moral judgment that violent tactics are more effective or more morally apropos than nonviolent tactics. And then some people believe that only nonviolent tactics are morally acceptable. Acceptable to whom? I think that people, each individual activist or each collective of activists, can make an assessment of where their personal comfort zone ends, moving toward nonviolence or toward violence or toward pacifist property destruction or toward non-pacifist property destruction. But whether or not they're going to let that be a barrier to their nexusing with other activists in other movements, I think that that's a real shame. I don't have any problem working with people on any kind of end of the spectrum in terms of morally, other than murder. Like the deliberate taking of human life is a place that I'm not personally comfortable to go. I also wouldn't go in the direction of deliberate taking of animal life, but certainly nobody at this table is going to be talking about that. But there also are really strategic considerations. I think that there are ways in which acts of property destruction can be undertaken that are more strategically effective than other ways. Sometimes spontaneous acts can have impact. For example, urban riots subsequent to incidents of police brutality that foment momentum for a citizen review board or something like that. Other times, I think that they can simply backfire or have no effect.
Well, something I said at the beginning of the show, that we need to reject the status quo's definition of violence, I hear sort of resounding in this group, and I think it's important. It's not merely a semantical distinction. It's important for how we operate in the real world. We do need to reject the mores that elites force on us, that the mainstream media forces on us. We need to say, hey, it's not violent. What's violent is Nike condemning entire populations to sweatshops. What's violent is to fucking pay $150 for a tennis shoe and to support that system. To the extent that taking Nike apparel and throwing it in a fountain rejects that violence, it's healthy and it's life-affirming. Now, people could have chosen to chain themselves to the door and let themselves get dragged off by the police, but they chose instead to do something different that I frankly support. I'll say it. I support it. I don't think our movement or any of us here should lose an ounce of sleep about Nike. They have it coming. They're criminally insane bastards who are being enabled by a criminally insane society. And the sooner we shake that dust off our feet, any and every way, the better.
Tim, I lost my strict adherence to pacifism in 1987-88 when I lived in Southern Africa for 2 years. And I saw the struggle that the African National Congress was involved in while Nelson Mandela was still jailed. And I felt there was no possible way, given what I saw the apartheid regime involved in, that I could condemn attacks on the military that could have resulted even in what you might call murder or you might call self-defense, depending on what side. Semantically, you can go all over the map with that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. I won't condemn the actions that the Zapatistas are taking, even when they pick up automatic weapons and are ready to fire them at people after 500 years of genocide. But I think we need to keep in mind that if we're talking about that kind of situation here at home, we got to remember that we're in a country armed to the teeth, and the vast majority of the guns, I think, are held by, number one, the United States government, which is largely in control of generals that don't agree with us, and corporations that pay those boys the big dollars to do what needs to be done, and number two, sort of what I would call the good old boy faction. Everything from the construction worker with the pickup truck that probably doesn't see eye to eye about veganism with me, and yet, you know, has a pretty good stock of weapons, all the way on up to well-organized right-wing militia that are in charge of whole counties in Montana already. So if we want to talk about, like, suddenly not having social order, and that the rule of the day might be might makes right, and that we're in a situation where it's so violent already to the whole rest of the world via our corporate domination of the world for American consumerism, we have to, I think, maintain a level of personal first discipline and social discipline that's not about having fun fucking shit up. It's about being able to clearly articulate why we would engage in such drastic means, and then being very clear about when that has reached its limit, either in effectiveness or ineffectiveness. And I don't feel like there's anybody out there right now that's clearly articulating that, either in the realm of property destruction or in the realm of revolution, although I know lots of people that talk about it a lot.
Well, I hate to butt in again, but one of the reasons that they're not effectively articulating it is that this movement is selling them out by condemning them using the language of the status quo. I think it's our responsibility, most of us who are sort of above ground, to reject that language so that that message can be heard.
James, do you think then that it's one thing to say that it's not morally wrong to do it, but it's another thing to say that it's strategically effective? Would you go for as far as to say that, and why?
I don't support anything that's not strategically effective.
I'm not really shedding any tears about Vail or Nike either.
Right.
Okay, but were they effective?
Well,
I mean, I'm not saying you can, you know, blanket statement say arson will always be effective, right?
I see some other people around the table who would speak to that.
John?
Well, I think strategically effective requires a start. And I've really been struck at how quickly, really, the dialogue has changed, and I would say been improved by the acts that have happened, not only Vail and Nike, but in the neighborhood in Whitaker. Before, I don't know who you could have interested really in such a discussion, much less a discussion of the type, well, I think this business should be targeted rather than that one. I mean, it would have been unheard of. I mean, and sometimes we forget that suddenly now we're talking, we have moved on, and I think that's highly interesting that the acts themselves create a new
space.
Exactly. And so then we're already moving in the direction of strategic importance. When everything is accommodationist and in the same old tracks, and no one has the courage, the moral courage that some people have to burst through that, that's the difference, I think.
Yeah, I agree with that. I was going to simply comment that, you know, you said in the same breath in your statement just now, Vail and Nike. We all know what Vail is. We know what happened there. And nationally, people know that. You can say Vail, and people, you know, who read the papers at least know what they were talking about. And Nike, at least in this area, locally, we all know what happened there.
one more protest probably would not give it that kind of recognition and understanding of the two issues, destruction of the habitat on the mountain at Vail. And I think people in this area know about Nike practices, but bringing it to that level of outrage, I think, is something new to people in this area. Imagine that. People can get outraged enough to knock a few store displays over virtual slavery. It's crazy, isn't it, that people would get that upset over slavery? You know, I mean, I think it's effective because it's making it out there. And just a tangential point, talking about discipline and having fun, well, it seemed like what the Black Bloc had to do at Nike the other day was a fairly disciplined action. I mean, they went in there, they did what they did, and they got away. And whether or not they survive an intense police search for them in the long run is unimportant. What matters is they were much more effective and disciplined than a lot of CD or rallies and things like that that I've seen happen.
I definitely concur that there's value implicit in creating discursive space, but one of the particular types of discourse you mentioned in terms of delineating which types of businesses to target, I think that that's particularly of value. I think that there are some people who truly believe that enacting any property destruction at all has implicit value, and others who believe in selectivity in that, just like some people are very selective in where they shoplift, preferring to shoplift from corporations rather than from family-owned businesses unless that family-owned business has been overtly gentrifying or overtly abusive in other ways. I personally tend to favor the selective targeting strategy, although I honor that both can have impact, but I believe they have different impacts. It's also interesting to me, as a self-titled pacifist, that I noticed a slight shift in how I felt about Vail after I read this article. This is from the Register Guard, just from yesterday, actually. Forest plan doesn't preclude ski resorts. Old growth reserves are not hands-off under a new interpretation of the 1994 plan. So here's these areas of intact ancient forest ecosystem that are now eligible to be clear-cut to put in ski resorts. And I noticed that that had more of a pang for me than hearing about lynx habitat. Perhaps it shouldn't have. Perhaps it's because, well, that was sort of far away. Like, I kind of know where Colorado is, but it's not my biorege, my issue kind of mentality in my head. Like, this struck an emotional chord for me that resonated more strongly with something like that.
Well, I might suggest that perhaps you shouldn't make that distinction because it's explicitly reformist, I would say. In other words, if we stay on the level of the excesses of certain businesses, this business is legitimately, or whatever you want to put it, should be trashed because they go over the line. You know, when you think about it, that really implicitly embraces the system of capital because that says that the other ones are fine on whatever other scale you choose because they're smaller or because of this or because they're liberal or not. In other words, that isn't a radical point of view. That's just, you know, this one is nice and this one isn't nice, which to me, the myth is the whole point. The whole system is the problem, not whether this business is really much more piggish than the other. Just as I feel that it's not a matter of personalities with pigs. I mean, so I'd rather deal with one that is less brutal than another. But what that overlooks, I mean, in terms of looking at it that way, is what is the function of police in society?
Mm-hmm.
And it's got nothing to do with whether they're nice or not. I mean, sometimes the liberal pig is more effective than the one who's just going to bash anybody he sees. They're more effective to the system. That doesn't mean you get a pat on the back or something, to me.
Tim?
I want to amplify first something that John said in his comment previous, which is the moral courage of the people who are at Vail or people who are at engaged in the Nike protest. One thing I think that a lot of people fail to recognize is that the vast majority of people involved in these kind of actions have absolutely nothing to personally gain from engaging in these kind of actions. They take a huge personal risk, primarily for other living beings that can't stick up for themselves,
mm-hmm.
or for other, including human beings that can't stick up for themselves. For instance, the primarily women, young women overseas that are working the 12-hour days or whatever at the Nike plant for less money than it takes to live. But I think right now, one thing we need to recognize is that the current system, of course, is violent. The current system is one where you take what you can. And there are some sort of rules, some sort of social rules in place that don't you allow you to just simply march into an Indonesian rainforest with any old army, you know, but it's close to that, right? And so my question is, where where exactly are we transitioning away from a system where simply whoever has the most guns can take what they want to a system where we're not picking these things up anymore? When do we get to the melt the guns part? Is it that the left has to engage in enough show of, not the left, but let's say radical politics or anarchist political perspective, whatever. Does there have to be like enough power from the people to actually dismantle the U.S. military industrial complex? And is that going to be able to be happened by rock throwing, acquisition of automatic weapons? I mean, what's the path to victory? And I agree that doing something is better than doing nothing, but I still don't necessarily see how we get from, I don't see how we shoot our way to a healthy earth.
One thing I did just want to say is there's not a whole lot of disagreement about the efficacy of these sorts of direct actions around this table. But there is in our larger movement. You read the newspapers, you read your email, you will see a lot of activists out there who roundly condemn the direct action at Vail and at Nike. They buy into the status quo's rhetoric about violence and condemn it to separate themselves from it. And I really want to issue a challenge, not to the people around this table, but to the people who might be out there listening to me, those people who are above ground, to please, please, please don't feed into those status quo mores that are keeping us down. I've been saying this all night, but I think it's real important. It's up to us who are above ground to change the dialogue, to alter the discursive space so that we can make genuine progress. To those who are underground, I'd just say keep your paws dry and don't get caught.
Ellen.
I would say a little more than that. I would say that I believe that there are ways in which mass actions of property sabotage can be conducted with greater concern or lesser concern to minimize actual harm to life or the risk of accidental harm to life. And underground groups can take the time to consider whether or not they want to do something like issue a warning, like have a mission abort backup plan if someone enters the building they're about to blow up or not. I wonder how much whoever the corporate entity that runs the ski resort that was destroyed by arson fire in Vail is really going to suffer financially, because I imagine they were insured to the hilt. So, you know, could the cell group have somehow created some sort of subterfuge that eliminated that insurance policy? So they really took
the next insurance policy. They drove up their insurance rates. They were paying a lot, and they're paying more now.
Okay, but what I'm saying is, hypothetically, if the owners of the ski resort didn't lose anything because of insurance, but the workers or the people in the town, or looking down further down the line.
Yeah, Vail's really hurting economically these days.
All right, fine.
Practically a ghost town.
But I believe that you understand the type of hypothetical consideration that I'm stating, that a cell group could conduct.
But Ellen, we can't let big corporations just throw up a bunch of bodies as lower class people as a shield to
human
kind of
shield.
Effective social change.
Human shield.
Oh well, these Thai women might not be making much in our shoe sewing plant, but if we pull out of here, then they're making nothing. You know, we can't.
That's kind of like
where will the slave eat if I don't feed him? You know.
That's what Phil Knight says in The Big One.
Okay, we're going to wrap it up with some closing comments from our crew here. Thanks, y'all, for coming out on a Wednesday night and doing this with us. James, would you like to start?
Yeah, I mean, we've been talking a lot about our own behavior, our own tactics, about violence or lack thereof. And it's good to remember that in these struggles, like environmental struggles, direct action, generally, it's them getting us, not us getting them. Let's not forget David Chain, who was recently murdered. Let's not forget the many people who've been beaten and bloodied and otherwise abused. The violence comes from them, most part, and not so much from us. And that's good to remember when the media is painting activists of all stripes out as baby-killing terrorists.
Helen?
Well, I was just thinking that, again, looking at the value of creating a space for dialogue that comes from certain actions, I believe that direct actions, including direct actions of property sabotage on a mass scale that are claimed, can be more effective when that kind of dialogue, I believe, is a direct action. And I believe that that kind of dialogue as direct action can is more likely to result and is more likely to be productive when the property sabotage is undertaken selectively with a pacifist tone and with accountability with people claiming the action.
I sort of feel like it's not corporations, it's not government, it's people that are being naughty. There are a lot of people, especially the ultra-rich, that are very naughty, and there's a lot of other people that are just sucking up to them to get their crumbs from the table. And what we need to do is we need to change behavior. And I think the most effective means generally for changing behavior is to provide information. So I view first and foremost what we're doing is we're providing information to people through very difficult means, corporate-controlled media for the most part, or as the main vehicle. But we have to provide information. That being said, I think the full spectrum of activists involved need to recognize and honor each other's work. There is an above-ground element to this movement that is striving for mass movement and is striving for inclusion of as many people without compromising values as possible. And there's an underground movement that is trying to reduce the power of the oppressor and trying to inspire and create the space for further dialogue. I think the people above ground have to, as much as they can and still remain safely above ground, need to honor the people that are on the underground side, mm-hmm. and the people that are underground and need as much as possible to support and work with the people that are above ground. So we're all working together, all pulling together. But ultimately, at the end of the day, we have to move to a society on this planet of radical nonviolence. Ultimately, we have to create a social structure or continue to move toward a social structure that is fully peaceful, respectful, and honoring of all forms of life. And so I just don't wonder whether or not people today who are willing to do that full on and accept full consequences, even if that means a single individual rotten in jail, like there are some of in our movement, if that's not really ultimately the inspiration for where we all have to go at some point.
Well, I disagree with you, Tim, in terms of information. I don't know how much more clear and stark things can get. Well, at the same time, one recognizes the amount of denial. I think what pierces through the denial, a lot of which is based on, well, yeah, everything is horrible. You can't miss that, but if you just read the newspaper once in a while. But maybe it's the rock throwers that are challenging the monopoly, the story that you can't do anything about it. In this postmodern culture where even meaning seems to be dissolving, I think that may be exactly what it takes. Is to move out, and the mass movement hopefully will follow. I certainly mean no disrespect for any pacifist, but sometimes it keeps striking me that if we think that things actually aren't so horrible and getting worse all the time, and the parts that are bad are responsive to these polite things where you just do your moral witness and then you sit there and you're arrested and so forth, I don't see how anyone can believe that that does anything. It just respects the whole ensemble of everything. I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't take courage to do that, but I'm wondering how that can change the idea that people can do things and are doing things. And already, I think what we've seen here, as I've said before, it's changing the level of the dialogue already. And that's not a mass thing, but we go toward a mass thing by some people that step out and do things against the grain.
Well, I've got a couple more minutes here, so I think I'll step out of my moderator role and throw my two cents in on the issue here. The thing that's been going around in my mind, inspired by an essay called The Abstract Wild by Jack Turner. In that essay, he talks about the sacred, and he talks about how when something is sacred to someone, one of the hallmarks of something being truly sacred is that when the thing that is sacred to them is blasphemed, the reaction to that will be immune to secular judgment. What the rest of society thinks about it is really irrelevant when something that you hold dear is threatened. And I think that understanding of the matter for something like Vail rings very true to me. I think the tendency in American society is for any radical actions to be critique in terms of a conforming normalcy, where if you speak out against authority, you have a problem with it. If you protest dolphins getting hunted in Japan, you have an infantile complex, and any sort of social critique is usually judged as a neurotic problem on behalf of the individual and not a real problem of society.
Well, I've already issued my challenge to the larger environmental and social justice movement out there to not accept, to reject the self-serving rhetoric of the status quo. We are not violent. Monsanto Corporation is violent. Nike Corporation is violent. Pacific Lumber is violent. DuPont is violent. It's not us. But on another note, let me just add a hint of reality to the situation. I really think that as things get worse and worse for a significant portion of the population, as things get worse and worse for the planet, you're going to see more and more of this, right or wrong, for better or worse. It's sort of like global warming. You might not like it. You might not even believe that it's happening, but it is. Get ready for it. A word to Phil Knight and Bill Gates, sleep lightly. You are on the wrong side of history. It's a bad spot to be.
This discussion was originally broadcast on November 4th on Cascadia Live, a weekly biocentric public access television program in Eugene, Oregon. It was produced by Cindy Noblett, audio edited by Fuji Cascadia. Comments can be sent to Post Office Box 12225, Eugene, Oregon 97440, or MICKEY at EFN.org.
That was a soundtrack of a roundtable discussion about issues of nonviolence and property destruction, which aired on Cascadia Alive in Eugene, Oregon in 1998. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
I'm going to tell all you fascists you may be surprised. Hatred cannot stop us. This one thing I know: the poll tax and Jim Crow and greed have got to go. You're bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. All you fascists are bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. You're bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. People of every color marching side by side, marching across the fields where a million fascists died. You're bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. All you fascists are bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. You're bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Take my union gun. Gonna end this world of slavery for this war is one you're bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. All you fascists are bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. You're bound to lose.